Welcome back. Ooh, oh man. Welcome back, everyone. We have a treat today. Someone asked for it, so we're gonna go over this little Ben Shapiro video. It's an interview he did about 5 days ago on Piers Morgan. Which, shout out to Piers Morgan. He has had a lot of very pro-Palestine guests on, especially near the start of the recent escalation in violence. But I think he's overall done a bad job at pushing back against his pro-Israel guests, in comparison to his pro-Palestine guests, who he pushes on, who pushes back against very hard. So I took some of Ben's best moments from this interview, and we're just going to go through them, and we're going to talk about why his arguments are very well steeped in logical fallacy, distortions of the truth, or just outright lies. For those of you who don't know, Ben Shapiro is probably one of the most prolific conservative political commentators on the internet today. Imagine if young Sheldon from the TV show was racist. That's Ben Shapiro in a nutshell. For a long time, he's been one of the biggest defenders of the Zionist state of Israel. All the way back in 2010, Ben tweeted, "Israelis like to build, Arabs like to bomb crap and live in open sewage. This is not a difficult issue. Hashtag settlements rock," which should tell you enough about his perspective on the issue, and should also disqualify him from any kind of nuanced conversation on the topic. But either way, we're gonna go through this interview he had with Piers Morgan, and we're gonna call out a lot of the bullshit that Ben peddles here. And ahead of time, I'm gonna tell you all, I'm very sorry that I have to subject all of you to this. Trigger warning, Ben Shapiro.
What I don't understand about Israel's strategy is how they perceive actual victory. Yes, you can take out the 30 to 35,000 Hamas terrorists. Yeah, maybe they can do that. And maybe in the process of that, they kill tens of thousands more civilians and have to deal with the contention that that will cause worldwide. And maybe Israelis don't care about that part as long as they get rid of Hamas. So let's get to an end game where Hamas has gone. Why does leveling Gaza, killing so many civilians, why would that give anyone in Israel any kind of comfort that that would kill off the ideology that fueled Hamas, that it wouldn't actually just lead to an increase in that ideology, more hatred towards Israelis, more hatred towards Jewish people? I've never quite understood what the end game looks like here for Israel that makes Israel more secure.
First of all, Piers is right here. Hamas is the manifestation of the worst of what is a byproduct, ultimately, of a belligerent military occupation. If you look at the West Bank, if you look at Gaza, you look at East Jerusalem, the one common denominator among all of these regions is the Israeli occupation. Hamas doesn't have any kind of meaningful control or capacity to mount any resistance within the West Bank or East Jerusalem. Yet we still see Palestinians there subjected to apartheid, subjected to colonial violence, and ethnically cleansed from their lands. And ultimately, yes, he's right. If you do eliminate Hamas, you're going to see another group, whether that is whether that comes from the remnants of Hamas or an entirely new group, you're going to see another militant resistance to the occupation, because you cannot have the complete oppression of an entire civilian population of people without them resisting. No people on earth have ever accepted their dispossession, have ever accepted their oppression, and why should Palestinians be any different? And I said this months ago, Hamas is an army of orphans. And where do you think those orphans came from? They came from the bombings, the periods of mowing the grass that Israel exerts on Gaza. But anyway, let's see what Ben's response is here.
Well, I mean, the end game presumably is security, not a sort of dynamic ideological scoring among a population that right now overwhelmingly supports the October 7th attacks, and prior to October 7th, overwhelmingly supported terror attacks against the state of Israel and overwhelmingly supported the destruction of the state of Israel. The sort of idea that more conciliation from Israel was bringing about peaceful conditions with the Palestinian Authority or with Hamas has been obviously proved false by the fact that Israel literally withdrew all IDF forces from the Gaza Strip in 2005. Hamas took control. They spent the last 20 years turning it into a giant terror base.
So first of all, that is one of those distortions of reality that we talked about. Yes, Israel withdrew militarily from Gaza, and then the people in Gaza elected Hamas, which they were elected in what was described by experts as a completely honest, fair, and free election. And the people of Gaza, according to Ben here, committed the great crime of voting the wrong way. And if people can be held accountable for the crimes of the government that they voted for, then I have some very bad news for Canadians and Americans. But the key part here that he leaves out is that Hamas was not given the chance to even govern Gaza, was not given the chance to even be a hypothetical partner for peace with Israel. Upon the consolidation of Hamas's power in Gaza after they overthrew a Israeli-US-backed coup attempt by the Fatah party, Israel imposed a blockade on Gaza, a complete blockade from the air, the land, and the sea. You would be hard-pressed to find any government on Earth that could effectively govern a population of people under these extreme circumstances. And the reality is, in practice, the amount of time that Gaza has not been occupied by Israel since 1967 is very, very small. Because of the scope of control and the complete domination that Israel exerts over Gaza, despite Hamas being the governing power in Gaza, the United Nations and the international community still widely considers Israel as the occupier of Gaza. And on Ben's point about radicalization and how the Palestinian people were radicalized prior to October 7th, he's doing a little bit of a chicken before the egg fallacy here. But either way, what he, I don't think maybe he doesn't understand, he's actually lending a lot of support to the idea that this did not start on October 7th. Like, gee, Ben, I wonder what radicalized those Palestinians prior to October 7th. And he's making his point here about radicalization and about how the effects of the Israeli genocide being perpetrated against Gaza right now are effectively null because, according to him, Palestinians are subhuman who are always radicalized no matter what. But in making this point, Ben is ceding the other point that this did not start on October 7th, that you have to acknowledge that those Palestinians in Gaza were radicalized by something prior to October 7th, which of course undoubtedly was the Israeli occupation and the periods of what Israel itself has described as mowing the grass in Gaza. And the first point he makes here, that Israel needs to create a situation where it ensures its security, and that it needs to consider the idea of its material security over the consideration of radicalization. And he just kind of glosses over the fact that security in the face of increasing radicalization as a result of genocidal violence is a game of diminishing returns here. Here he's engaging in a form of crackpot realism where for him, this is the cycle, and this is a cycle that is preferable to Zionists and Israelis, where they get to maintain a quote-unquote legitimate concern about their security, which then in turn fuels the further radicalization of the Palestinians in Gaza and the further oppression militarily of the Palestinians. It is a sick cycle, and quite frankly, the only people that this cycle works for are Israelis and Zionists. It is the status quo that they are looking to maintain. And that's not just me saying this. That's been the position of the Israeli government. Most notably, Israeli media broke the news that the Netanyahu government had been funding Hamas in Gaza, intentionally wiring them funds to keep them in power because they saw it as a preferable governing body to Fatah. You know, and Ben belongs to the group, like many others, who are concerned about Israel's safety in the face of what the material reality is within Gaza right now and how it has been since 1967. These are the same people who would be concerned about the security of the German people had the prisoners in the concentration camps been liberated? And this is where Ben and much of the international community, mainly the United States, proves himself quite morally bankrupt when you consider that the security of Israel, in their view, comes exclusively from the oppression and the subjugation of another people.
From the Israeli perspective, my assumption is that what they are figuring is degrade Hamas's military capacity such that they cannot be an offensive threat to the state of Israel, and then try to enact some sort of military control of the area sufficient to prevent any future threat from arising from that area. So,
the prisoners in the concentration camp are rebelling, and Ben's solution is to neutralize the rebels within the camp and return it to the status quo of a subservient population who is just going to lie down there and die. This is Ben's grand solution. This is Ben's the intellectual titan of the right. This is what he thinks is going to ensure the security of Israel.
I'm sure that Israel would love to hand the area over to Egypt. Egypt says no. Egypt doesn't want any part of it. Israel would love to hand it over to Jordan. Jordan says no. Jordan doesn't want any part of it. Israel's tried to hand it over to the Saudis, to the UAE, to the United States, to literally anyone. No one wants to run that area, specifically because the population is already quite radicalized and was radicalized before October 7th.
I'm glad that Ben said that, because this is a huge talking point that you hear from a lot of Zionists pertaining to Israel-Palestine. They always ask, why aren't these other Arab countries accepting Palestinian refugees? Why don't the Arab countries step up and take responsibility for the Palestinian territories? And the answer is really quite simple, because it is not their responsibility. They are not the countries that are creating the massive humanitarian crisis there. They are not the countries who are creating the power vacuums there that demand a legitimate sovereign. What that is essentially Israel demanding that the other countries in the region clean up their mess. And secondly, this is another very racist idea that you hear within Zionist discourse, that they are all Arabs, that Egyptians, people from Jordan, Lebanese people, Syrians are all Arabs, and thus the Palestinians being Arabs will seamlessly integrate into their nations. You know, and it's very racist just to completely ignore the distinct cultural and national identities of those people. Palestinians are not going to seamlessly integrate into Egypt. And furthermore, these countries, a lot of them don't have the capacity to take in that many Palestinian refugees, or to, in fact, even govern from afar the territories of Palestine. Egypt, for example, is already facing a huge overpopulation problem. About 5% of the land in Egypt is actually viable and usable. You know, if you look at a heat map of population density in Egypt, most of the people live within a couple miles at most of the Nile River. And essentially the argument here is that Israel is so concerned with racial and ethno purity that it is unwilling to extend citizenship status or to take in even refugees for a small period of time from the Palestinian territories. And it's a very dangerous and very colonial black and white fallacy when they say, we are Jews, this is a country for Jews, you are all Arabs, take in the Arabs, they should go where they belong.
And so what you're probably going to end up with, and I said this, I think, the first time I appeared on the show, which was shortly after October 7th in this context, what you're probably going to end up with is some form of joint military rule in the Gaza Strip, in which Israel has the intelligence capacity to go in and conduct raids in terror hotbeds, the same way that they do right now, for example, in the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, places like Jenin, places like Nablus. The IDF is constantly attempting to go in and root out terror cells in these particular areas. One of the big flaws that led to October 7th was the fact that Israel had no forces on the ground and no actual intelligence capability inside the Gaza Strip.
That's not true. That is a bold-faced lie. It's a complete fabrication. Israel controls foremost the population registry within Gaza. It knows the names and the ages of everybody who lives there, despite it not being quote-unquote occupied. I want everybody to play a little game right now. Go on your phone, go on whatever. Go on Google Earth and look at the satellite view of Gaza and see how long it takes you to find an Israeli drone over Gaza. It doesn't take long. There are a lot of them. Israel maintains a barrier around Gaza that is patrolled 24/7 from the air and from the ground. Prior to October 7th, on October 6, 2023, Israel was still controlling every single consumer product that went into Gaza. They were controlling everything that went in, from textiles to building material. In fact, on the morning of October 7th, members of Israel's intelligence apparatus tried to warn the higher-ups within the Shin Bet that militants were amassing at the barrier, and that it looked like there was an attack that was imminent, and they were ultimately brushed off by the higher-ups within the Shin Bet apparatus. Gaza is under the control of Israel, one of the most surveilled places on the planet, rivaled only second to the West Bank and East Jerusalem. People talk about totalitarian regimes and are worried about it becoming 1984 here in Canada. But right now, the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, they live 1984. For Ben to claim that there was no means of surveillance within Gaza, that Israel had no surveillance capacity over Gaza, is just, it's a flat-out falsehood. It's not true.
One of the consequences of this war has been a lot of very high passions on both sides, a lot of angry disagreements. You and your company have been at the center of a very high-profile one at the moment with Candace Owens, who's now left Daily Wire. Was she fired, or did she leave of her own volition?
I'm not going to speak to this topic, Pierce.
At all?
At all.
You can't give me any insight into why she departed?
No hints, no nothing. I'm not going to speak to this.
Can I ask why?
I mean, you can ask.
No, I'm not. Can I ask why you don't want to say anything?
Again, you can ask.
I can speak to it, though. And I can tell you that the reason why Ben's not answering this question is because he really doesn't have a leg to stand on in this discussion at all. You know, presumably, of course we don't know, but presumably Candace Owens was fired from the Daily Wire for anti-Semitism. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with Candace Owens, she is a conservative political commentator. She is black. Despite that, she continually and consistently espouses white nationalist talking points. And she has always been anti-Semitic. Candace Owens has always been Nazi adjacent. And Ben Shapiro knew this when he hired her. She had said things before her hiring at the Daily Wire, like Hitler was a great leader, his only problem was he had aspirations outside of Germany. Just shit like that. And then October 7th comes, and Candace Owens is providing a view of Israel that is critical, that goes against what Ben holds most dear, is the state of Israel. You know, she has conversations with Norman Finkelstein, and she talks very critically about Israel. Do I laud Candace Owens for this? No, she's a fucking Nazi, and she's an anti-Semite. But her anti-Semitism was never a problem before for Ben until she started talking about the issue of Palestine. And that just goes to show that when it comes to Zionists, anti-Semitism is never the problem, and it never has been the problem. It's always been Palestinian human rights, and anybody who wants to speak up about Palestinian human rights. And that is a problem that a lot of Zionists who are conservatives, primarily Ben Shapiro, run into, is that when you get into bed with people who are white supremacists, like Steven Crowder, like Candace Owens, like Michael Knowles, there is an inherent anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is a huge part of this like ultra-far-right white nationalist movement. But Ben has never really had a problem with that anti-Semitism until the issue of Palestine is brought up. And it's not even like every anti-Semite is pro-Palestine. There are, I would argue, the majority of anti-Semites are pro-Israel. You see, in North America, there's a huge movement of Christian Zionism. Some of the most anti-Semitic people in politics are vehemently pro-Israel, such as Donald Trump, Ann Coulter, just to name a few. Marjorie Taylor Greene. You know, and Ben doesn't want to speak to this issue because it is so symbolic of the fact that he is ultimately subservient to Israel and not to Judaism. He is in favor of Zionism and not actually combating real anti-Semitism, because Israel is the epitome of everything that he holds dear. It is a settler colonial state that is obsessed with racial purity, that has a very, very strong nationalistic, chauvinistic character. It's heavily militarized. It governs by religion. It is the thing that, like, Ben Shapiro creams his chinos over every single day.
I'm only curious because I know what a staunch defender of free speech you are. And it would surprise me if it had been someone's opinions that would make you want to part company with them. However contentious.
I mean, suffice it to say, the only thing I will say is what I've said all along with regard to Candace or with regard to any of our other hosts. I am not in hiring and firing position with the Daily Wire. I'm a co-founder of the Daily Wire. I'm a co-owner of the Daily Wire. I'm not actually in management.
That's bullshit. We all know he wants somebody gone, they're gone.
Jeremy Boring and Caleb Robinson are in management positions with regard to Candace or anyone else. And as far as the free speech situation, what I will say is that no company has the obligation to literally pay anyone. The Daily Wire is a publisher. It is not a platform. I've never called for Candace or anyone else for that matter to be banned from YouTube, to be banned from X, to be banned from any platform. That's a different story, obviously, when it comes to any publisher. Any publisher gets to make decisions about what it wishes to purvey and not.
I mean, I'm just not going to labor this, but one more point I would make is it's been reported extensively that the reason for her departure was because her comments have been perceived by people at the Daily Wire as anti-Semitic.
Again, I'm not going to comment on this, Piers.
Okay. Rabbi Shmuley, would you comment on him? Because Jeremy has actually commented on Rabbi Shmuley. He said, I've avoided commenting publicly on Rabbi Shmuley because as far as I can tell, the man is an attention whore of the highest order. Is that the general position of the company on Mr. Shmuley?
I mean, that's my personal position for sure. I mean, I think that, you know, Rabbi Shmuley happens to be a person with whom I agree on some matters related to, say, Middle East policy. And I also believe that his devotion to camera and notoriety have made him do some untethered things in recent days.
What I will say about Rabbi Shmuley is that it is insane that he is actually like a figure or a part of the discussion on Middle East politics. He's a charlatan. He's a dildo salesman who somehow is on Piers Morgan debating Norman Finkelstein on Israel-Palestine. That's insane. And then the rest of the interview, they talk about Rabbi Shmuley and it's just like culture wars bullshit, which I mean, it's the same tune. It's not worth covering. Ben Shapiro's like, I'm racist, I'm transphobic, and I talk fast. This is why. But anyway, I hope you listened to this episode and gained a lot of knowledge. And I hope this inspired you to take a more critical look at a lot of the people who are in the business right now of laundering the Israeli genocide in Gaza. And, you know, the biggest way that we can fight this is with more education and with more learning. It's crazy that Piers Morgan let Ben Shapiro go on TV, that Ben Shapiro can get on TV and say so many things that are demonstrably incorrect. So ultimately, we need to correct these falsehoods where we see them, and we need to reject the notion that you can launder a genocide like this. Until next time, everybody, thank you for listening. Free Palestine. Have a good day.